Okay, like I said, we'll start our lesson on page 83, but before we do that, I want you to put your finger there and go back to page 16. We are following this process of building a fire. Remember, in this quarter, we're talking about, of course, zeal. And zeal, so many times, is equated to the concept of a fire. In fact, we even use that language sometimes, somebody being on fire for the Lord. And that is synonymous with the idea of zeal. In this lesson, he uses the seven steps in kind of building and using a fire, and then parallels that to the idea of building and using our zeal. The top of page 16, here's the steps in building a fire or using a fire. Number one is preparing the place. Number two, you have to have a lighter or a match, some source of a spark or a flame. To properly arrange the firewood, the fuel that would burn. At times you need to shield it from strong winds or rain. And then he says cook some s'mores, but there's the idea of using the fire. You don't just build a fire for a fire's sake. You use it for warmth or to cook or to do something with. And then you might share its heat with others. And then, obviously, to stir the coals, maybe add more fuel to it to maintain that fire. And so the seven steps correspond this way. Step one is prepare your zeal. Remember, we talked about the idea of before you build a fire, you want to clean things away. And in our lives, there may be some things we need to clean away. There may be some sin in our life. There may just be clutter in our lives that we need to remove some things and so that we can focus more upon spiritual matters. And so we need to prepare the place for this zeal. To ignite the zeal, remember we used the illustration of here's the flame and here's the candle. They have to be close to one another. In fact, God says, draw closer unto me and I'll draw closer unto you. And so we have to get close to God. And so, in that point, I can't remember if it's in this lesson or one of the next lessons coming up, is that concept that when zeal is talked about in the Bible, the Bible really never just says, go after it. And that's kind of what maybe our approach would be to somebody who wouldn't be zeal. Well, just go do something. The approach the Scriptures take mostly is the idea of getting closer to God. And really the zeal kind of takes care of itself. The fire will take care of itself if we draw closer to the source of that fire, which is God. Then we need to fuel that zeal. There are certain things that we need to do in order to add the fuel to the fire, the logs or the straw or whatever that which might burn. And we need to fuel that zeal through encouragement, through some different things that we can do. We have to protect our zeal like you would protect a fire from wind or rain. Our zeal must be protected from Satan and the enemies that would extinguish that fire. Step five is the idea of using the zeal. We don't just have zeal just for zeal's sake. It's like you don't build a fire just to have a fire. You build it for a purpose. And so we talked about some uses of that zeal. In fact, those last lessons, remember the last lesson we talked about the idea of the personality type that we have. It might tell us which way we should best use our zeal. And now we are on the idea of spreading that zeal. Sharing it with others is the concept here. Spreading that zeal. And then, of course, we'll wrap up with the idea of tending that zeal. Taking care of it so that it might be maintained. So, that's where we are on the list. We're in step 6 of 7, the idea of zeal. Page 83, again, lesson 17. Is this idea of spreading that zeal, sharing this heat with others. And this is kind of mixing metaphors, really, but it's not just the idea of here's a flame and we're going to get other people to come stand around this flame, but it's more the idea of here's someone with some fire and someone else with some fire, and we put those fires together, and they burn brighter and hotter. And I think that's more the concept rather than just saying, here's a flame, okay, everybody come stand around this flame. That's not really descriptive of what we're talking about. We're talking about spreading the zeal. But the idea of, you might think of it, I think of an old movie of maybe somebody in a cave and they have the torch here, this, and someone comes up with one that's not ignited and they touch it to that one and it spreads in that way. That's the idea of spreading the flame, encouraging others. And it in itself is going to become, again, so much of this is self-perpetuating the zeal, using the zeal. The best way to lose zeal is to not use it. We've all heard the adage, use it or lose it. We've all experienced that adage, haven't we? All of us at one time maybe were in better physical shape. We could go play tennis. We could go run, do those kind of things. But we didn't do that for a while, and now we can't do that. Maybe you've done it in an educational thing. If you took algebra or geometry in high school or college, if you're not in that field, you're like me, you probably couldn't do an algebra problem if your life depended on it. Or a geometry problem, you're just one of those things, you haven't used it in a while. Language is that way. You study a foreign language. Maybe you took a foreign language in high school or in college, French or Spanish or something. And again, unless you stayed up on that, you might know enough to order at the Mexican restaurant, but maybe barely that. Maybe you can count to 10. You know, for some reason we remember that part of the language. But if you don't stay fresh on it, it is just becomes dormant. And that's the way it is with zeal. The more we use it, the more frequent it's going to be replenished, and the better we're going to be at that. And so this is one of those cases where certainly it is self-perpetuating, the idea of sharing and experiencing this zeal with others. He starts with one of my favorite biblical quotes in Proverbs 27, verse 17. This is right under the title there on page 83. Iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. What does that verse mean to you? Somebody explain that verse for me.
Verse I start all my training classes with at work.
Oh, okay. Well, then you should know what it means. Some translations translate it as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. But, Harold, what does that verse mean?
Just exactly training. It's one person teaching another person to sharpen and hone their skills. Person who has the ability, pass that ability on.
And sometimes, maybe implied in that, sometimes that's a somewhat painful process. You know, iron sharpening iron is not a smooth process. There's some rubbing and some grating going on there. And so maybe it's going to require some admonition and some correction. I want to look at another verse, a New Testament passage that I think is somewhat related to that. Look at 1 Thessalonians 5. As iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens or strengthens or encourages another. God made us, and I've made this statement before, I know you've probably heard me make it, but God made us social beings. And I hate that religion, to a large degree, to a lot of people, has become nothing more than social in its most common and carnal sense. And so it's taken away, I think, some of the meaning of this, that God made us social. And I think you'll know the way in which I mean this. If not, I'll try to explain it. That's a part of the New Testament church. That's part of the local church. I don't mean social in the sense that we get together for coffee and donuts. That's the way we normally mean social. But I'm just talking about in the sense that we talk about socialize. You might know somebody who's an introvert that's just a hermit, and you might say to them, you need to get out and socialize. You know, go meet some other people, be around some other people, interact with them. That's the sense in which I mean social. There are exceptions to that. There are hermits and true introverts. But for the most part, we're social beings. We want to be with other people. We need that interaction. And God made us that way. And he incorporated our spirituality that way. You know, he could have made religion, could have made Christianity a secret society. He could have said, here's what you do to become a Christian. And then, like he said to some people when he performed miracles when he's here upon earth, but don't tell anybody. You don't tell anybody that you just obeyed the gospel. You keep this just between you and me. You don't tell another soul about your faith in me. He could have designed it that way, but he didn't, did he? He told us to be social with that. And by social, again, I don't mean ball teams and coconut, where'd that come from? That's combining coffee and donuts, I guess. But not in that sense, but in this sense, that we are to seek out others of a mutual faith, aren't we? And we're to associate with them. Now, that association is to be spiritual, but we're to be together. And we draw encouragement from that. And also in the sense that we are to evangelize, recruit others so that they might be included in this. And so God used this innate quality of that he put within us to be social, to be around other people, and made it a part of our faith. He says, you go find others of a like precious faith, use Peter's term, and you associate with them. You draw that spiritual strength with them. And you go out and you use your social interactions to find others and teach them the truth. And that is that iron sharpening iron, being with one another and associating with one another. But notice the language in 1 Thessalonians 5. Someone read verse 14. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 14.
We exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly, confront the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, be patient with all.
I love this verse for various reasons, but one is that the Apostle Paul categorizes different Christians, doesn't he? Look at the categories of Christians before we talk about the responsibility we have toward them. We have the unruly. How would you define unruly? In fact, you may have a definition or a reference there that might tell you something about that.
Undisciplined.
Okay, undisciplined.
Idle.
Idle, that's probably relates to the people that he may have in mind, those who are lazy. Remember Thessalonica, there were those who refused to work. This is the letters where he says, if you won't work, you shouldn't eat. But
insubordinate.
Okay, insubordinate. It's really, literally, it's the word out of step. Think about a military walking, and you know, it just walks in precision, left, right, left. And then think about one guy in there that's going right, left, right. When everybody else is going left, right, he's just out of step with everybody else. That's the word unruly. He's insubordinate, he's undisciplined, he's not following the pattern. He's not doing what he's supposed to do. That's unruly. Now, the second category, let me just write these up here. What's the second category?
Faint-hearted.
Faint-hearted. That's another interesting word. In the original, it literally is the combining of two different Greek words that literally says little soul. And maybe we would translate the word in our language heart, little heart. That they're faint-hearted. They've got just a little heart. They're not the strongest. They're faint-hearted is a good translation of that. They've got a little soul. They're not full of soul. They're just weak is the idea here of just faint-hearted. Maybe something has made them that way, that has discouraged them. And I think of, when I think of that idea of little soul or little heart, I think maybe of a patient in the hospital. And you can just see they're hooked up that machine and we're worried because it's just barely blipping. When it really ought to be going, you know, like that. But they're faint-hearted. And make a spiritual application. If we could hook somebody up to a spiritual EKG that we all know somebody, and maybe in our own lives where we've been that way, to where we were just spiritually speaking, there were just a little bit of a sign of life there. Okay, the third category is weak. Different than faint-hearted, that maybe faint-hearted implies that something has led to this condition. Weakness is more of just an overall condition. That maybe here somebody is just not spiritually strong and has been that way maybe for a while. In that case, maybe an implication, a distinction here between one is the weakness is more of that person's fault completely. They just haven't applied themselves. The faint-hearted has had something happen maybe to them that has weakened their condition. Maybe is a distinction there. Pat?
It's in faint-hearted sometimes used like cowardly.
Yes. Yeah, it can mean that. We speak of someone who is brave as being lion-hearted, and kind of full-hearted is the idea. And this can be somebody who is timid and fearful in that sense. And then he says, all, which I would take by implication, you may disagree with me here, but I think he puts in an unspoken category there of the strong when he says all. These are different degrees of spiritual weakness or spiritual sickness, we would agree. And I think with the all that he's not just saying those who are spiritually weak or sick, but every Christian, whatever category. And so if we just make one category of the strong, I think that would be included in that. So here we've got three, maybe by implication, four categories of Christians. But what strikes you about how Paul says we're to address those? Do we approach everybody the same way? No. There's differences there, aren't they? It's back to school time. We all know that the best teachers are those that don't treat all the students alike. Now, we're not talking about having favorites and a teacher's pet and discriminating against some. Not in that sense, but in the sense that you have to treat children differently, don't you? They're different. They have different personalities. Maybe they're at different levels of ability, of reasoning. And so you've got to, and one of the challenges of a teacher is to be able to help this one. This little girl here is so timid that you look at her sideways and she's going to bawl and cry. And old tough scruff Billy over there, you've got to wear him out with a switch just to get his attention. And this little girl over here is just as sharp as a tack. She probably ought to be two grades ahead of everybody else. And this poor little boy in the back corner over here, he's got a learning disability. But we've got to teach the same subject to all of those. And so, but we have to treat them differently. That's what he says here. We are to warn the unruly, warn or admonish. This is the idea of, here's that smart aleck, that Chris, what was the word?
Insubordinate
one. The idea here is he's walking out of step, but he's not doing it because he's not coordinated. He's just doing it because he wants to do it. Well, you go back and I can almost see that's a military word, the idea here. You can almost imagine what a drill sergeant is going to do to that person. He's not going to say, now, get with the rest of it. He's not going to do that, is he? He's going to get down there and jerk a knot in that guy's tail and straighten him up. And that's kind of the idea here. Somebody who's just misbehaving sometimes needs sternness. That's the word admonish or warn. But what do we do to the faint-hearted? Do we go snatch them up like that and get them told? Comfort or encourage them. Comfort's a good word, but comfort maybe has the implication of you just kind of pat them and say it's okay. But really the word comfort is encourage, is the idea of we don't want them to remain faint-hearted, so we don't just pat them and say that's okay. There's more of a gentle approach there. Encourage the faint-hearted. What do we do to the weak? We uphold them. Here's somebody that and I get the picture here of somebody who's been injured maybe on a football field or something, and they go over there and they put their arms around it and they help that person. You uphold that weak and carry them and help them with that burden. I think of Paul's passage
in the book of Galatians, the idea of bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law. And then we're patient with all. We're long-suffering with all, regardless of their spiritual condition. So here's this idea of encouraging others, iron sharpening iron, but we sharpen people different ways, don't we? It's not all just iron against iron. We approach people really in the spiritual condition that they're in, and we need to mold that according to their spiritual needs and encourage and spread this zeal that way. One of the best encouragements that you can be is to be able to identify people. It, not in a condescending way, but just to identify, this is what this person needs. This person needs a kick in the seat of the pants. This person needs encouraged. This person needs helped. They need carry along. I mean, we can illustrate that. Let's use the most visible thing, and this is maybe makes it a bad example because I don't mean to imply that this is the essence of our Christianity and the only thing that matters, but many times it's the most visible thing to us, and sometimes it's a warning sign, and that is church attendance. Let's just imagine that we've got three members here at Helton Drive who are missing services. One person has been a Christian for a long time, was a Bible class teacher, song leader, filled in some preaching, and was just here consistently all the time. But something's happened, and they're just got to where they just come just on Sunday mornings and sparse at that. Here's somebody else that's just recently obeyed the gospel. And they weren't, quote, raised in the church. They just were a worldly person that was taught the truth. And they've just been a Christian a couple months, and their attendance is about as regular as that other person. They're just here on Sunday mornings, but then it's not every Sunday morning. Somebody else whose attendance is sparse, but they're going through a divorce and has filed bankruptcy. And we can see that the symptom is the same, isn't it? And that's the way we need to view church attendance, is that's a symptom of a spiritual weakness there. But I think we can see that there's three different scenarios, aren't there? And they maybe need to be dealt with in three different ways. To the one who was a Bible class teacher, fill-in preacher, song leader that just quit, it might be they need to kick in the seat of the pants. Now, maybe we need to first find out there may be some problems in their life. But if we come to find out, no, everything's going good. They just gotten busy with worldly things. Well, that we might be to be the idea of here, we need to admonish them, warn them. That babe in Christ, we can't approach them the same way that we approach that mature Christian who knows these things. They may not have ever been taught that this is important to their spiritual life and their spiritual growth. The person who's going through a divorce and has filed bankruptcy, they need some support. We need to uphold them for a little while and help them, encourage them, all the while telling them and trying to show them that you need this. You need to be here. More than we need you here, you need to be here because we can comfort you and encourage you and uphold you and maybe admonish you. But there's the idea of sharing this, spreading this zeal, but we spread it in different degrees and in different ways, depending upon the people that we're dealing with. That's a biblical principle. Now we talk about the idea of spreading this among our friends and our family. And this is the obvious place where we're going to want to share this zeal. This is the people that are closer to us. He talks about the principle of building your house like an ark. And I like that concept of the ark, and the idea here is that the ark saved Noah and his family not just from the flood, but a good Bible student knows that the ark didn't just save them from the rising waters of the flood, it saved his family from what? Yeah, the evil, the corruption that was in this world. Our house, our home, our family needs to be that ark. that protection from the evil world. And we need to have that kind of that spiritual ark. We build that according to page 84, according to God's blueprints, understanding that we're carrying God's precious cargo, and we're trusting, absolutely trusting, in God's promises for this. And we need to make sure that our homes can be that kind of isolation, that separation from the world, and that ark that we can rise above the sinfulness that is going to destroy this world. We need to forge new friendships that will challenge us. He challenges in this lesson to look for friends whose zeal for God challenges you to live courageously and selflessly. We understand there's so many principles that we understand in the secular world that we fail to apply in the spiritual world. We understand this in secular issues, that if you want to be better at something, be around somebody who's good at that. If you want to be a better golfer, don't go golfing with me. I'm going to drag you down. Go play golf with somebody who's better than you, who's going to challenge you to kind of keep up with them. We understand that on a secular level in so many different ways. We need to understand that in a spiritual way. We talked about the idea of church attendance for these different people. One of the things we would emphasize to all three of those categories is that you need your brethren. Yes, you need to be here to obviously glorify and worship and reverence God. You need to fulfill that command. But God also made this because you need it. You need to be around some other Christians, especially stronger Christians, and who can maybe help pull you up and to encourage you and uphold you. Find those friends who have this same kind of passion, this same kind of zeal, and it will make you a better person. My best friend growing up, we did everything together. We went to school together. We went to church together. Our first two jobs, we had the same jobs together. And still a faithful Christian, as far as I know. His brother took a different path. His brother's not a faithful Christian. When he left home after high school, I don't know that he's ever been to church again, never given any thought to any spiritual matters. And I asked my friend one time, I said, you know, the good study there, because they were two brothers raised in the same home. You're spiritually minded, your brother's not. What's the difference? I was asking, why? Why did you take this path and your brother took the other path? And my friend said, you know, I don't really know the answer to that. He said, one thing I do know is that my brother's friends weren't Christians. They were worldly people. Most of my friends were either Christians or they had some kind of moral basis to them. They went to church somewhere. And he said, my brother chose a different kind of friend. Now, you can argue psychologically, chicken and the egg is, you know, which came first in that. But there's a lesson there. The idea of seeking out those people who are spiritually minded and zealous. If you are serious about being spiritually minded, if you're serious about being zealous, then you need to get next to those people who are. If you're serious about being a better golfer, you need to find somebody that's better than you at golf and hang out with them. If you're serious about being spiritually minded and zealous, then you need to find friendships that are going to challenge you. That, for lack of a better word, Christian friends who make you look bad. That you might want to kind of keep up with them. I got to do better. They're always reading their Bible. And so I'm going to start bringing my Bible to work because they're making me look bad. That, you know, they're talking to their friends about religious things, and I'm talking about what was on TV last night, and so they're making me look bad, and so I'm gonna have to get better at this. Iron sharpens iron. Here's this concept there. Take a solid stand. He uses examples of both Jesus and his family, Joshua, of course, and his family. We're familiar with his stand. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. We just have to take a stand and say, I'm going to have, for my house, my ark, we're going to have this moral standard. We're not going to do that. Other people may, But we just don't do that. We don't talk that way in this house. We don't act that way. We don't watch those kind of things. We don't live that way. Those who have children or grandchildren, he uses the phrase, raise children to move mountains. He uses the example of Philip, who was recognized for his virtuous daughters. Of course, we're very familiar with Timothy and the influence of his mother and grandmother, that Paul attributes much of Timothy's spiritual strength and knowledge to those two women. We need to impart that to our children. I saw a thing the other day, and I can't remember the quote exactly. It says, if you're not teaching your children to serve God, the world is teaching your children not to serve God. The world's not going to teach them. I mean, that's one of those duh statements, but it's one that we need to understand the impact of it. The world's not going to teach your children to be spiritually minded. That's going to be our responsibility. And I love this last one. He talks about plan to participate in good deeds together. You know, when Moses in the book of Deuteronomy says, teach your children while they're sitting in the way, while they're walking, I don't know that Moses was saying, have Bible studies in those different postures. Maybe he was. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think an application of that is, we can teach our... Yes, we need to have Bible studies with our children. Open up the Bibles, teach them those kind of things. We need to do that. But we can do so much spiritual teaching in other ways. And one way is this, is plan to participate. Incorporate zeal into your existing activities. Teach your children about spiritual zeal. Let them see that in you. He says, perhaps you can use some vacation time to help others in need across town or across the globe. When training your kids to use the internet, teach them how to use it to investigate a charity or some other good work that they can participate in with you as individuals. Make a financial investment together. Teach your children about the idea of using our money to help others and to be good and supporting others who are in need. You know, sometimes we don't involve our children in grown-up activities. And I understand there's some grown-up activities that we don't want them to be privy to, you know. But sometimes we need to let our children know, hey, Mom and Dad are writing a check. We're giving some money. Not you. When you're doing this to your children, you're not doing this to toot your own horn. You're not violating Jesus' principle of sounding the trumpet. But you might say, look, you know, there's a needy family at church, and we're going to help them. In fact, they've got kids. Why don't you go through your toy box and get some toys that you don't play with anymore? Some good ones. We don't give them garbage, but some good toys you don't play with. And let them be involved in those kind of activities. Designate a specific amount of your monthly income for doing good, for those charitable deeds. And then, of course, spend time together at home. 50, 60 years ago, that wouldn't have been a point in a lesson book in a Bible class, would it? Because we just did that. Now, that's become, it's come from being a minor point to every passing year, it becomes a bigger and bigger type face, because we're losing that togetherness in our homes and togetherness with one another. The irony is that we have so many more ways to communicate, but yet we're using those means to separate ourselves. You think about, most of us in this can remember the time before cell phones, when we just had a home phone and you didn't even have an answering machine. If somebody wasn't home, it just rang and rang and rang, and you had to wait, call them back later. You know, now, if you don't get somebody and get an instant response, you're ready to call 911. Something's wrong. They didn't answer my phone, my text, my tweet, my email. You know, we expect that instant response. We've got so much more ways to communicate and connect. But if we're all honest with ourselves, we're probably more disconnected than we've ever been. And, of course, a lot of that we realize, and we're realizing now, that electronic communication is no substitute for one-on-one personal FaceTime. I don't mean that as an app on your phone, but real, you know, face-to-face communication. We need to use that. Nothing can replace that. In order for iron to sharpen iron, it has to come in contact with one another. You can't sharpen a knife over the internet or over the phone. It's got to come in contact. Again, God made us social. God didn't never intend it that we just all link together our computers on Sunday morning and communicate that way. God said, come together. Because He made us to need that sharpening, to need that spreading of the fire. Because sometimes my fire may be weak, and I need to get close to you. I need to get close to God, but maybe close to you. Borrow some of your fire that you can uphold me or comfort me or maybe kick me in the seat of the pants, as the case may be. All right, that was lesson 17. Sunday, we will do 18 and 19 together. 18 and 19 on Sunday.